The Parshanut does not take long to get going in Parshas Lech Lecha. I think we, even within the opening psukim, we will see that there are a number of observations in these psukim, perhaps things that we take for granted in a good way. We're used to certain approaches, but there are a number of questions that are worth asking, and we'll see how one of the great Mefarshim takes a somewhat different approach based on these questions. And as is often the case, the approach is as worth it for the questions as it is for the new approach. How would we summarize the events at the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha? Avram is told, he's wherever he is, he's in Haran, let us assume. That's a simple understanding, and Hashem speaks to him, tells him to go to Eretz Canaan, which he does, and that's that. That, in a nutshell, is the beginning of Lech Lecha. However, if we take a look at the opening pasuk, Vayomer Hashem al Avram, Hashem says to Avram, Lech Lecha, you go, Me'artzecha, u'mimolaldecha, me'beis avicha, el'ores asher areka, go from your land to the land that I will show you. So we note that Hashem does not explicitly tell Avram to go to Eretz Canaan, to the land of Israel. He leaves it somewhat more open to the land that I will show you. We assume that that land is none other than the land of Israel. But the pasuk doesn't specify this. Fortuitously, Avram actually does go to the land of Israel, which is good because that was the land in question. But he was never told to go there. But what we also need to take into account is that in the end of Parshas Noach, we see, and the Parsha is winding down, but it's not over until half Kaddish. Avram and his family are already on the way to Eretz Canaan. So this now becomes a very interesting command, whereby Hashem appears to Avram, who's already going to Eretz Canaan, and tells him to go to a land, and he doesn't say which it is, but Avram's going there anyway, and in the end, that's the land. And these are the points that we need to reckon with. And actually, the Sephorno, and of course the Sephorno is well capable of saying chidushim. The thing about the Sephorno is that his comments are very brief. They really need to be, one cannot hurry through. My uncle Rav Kuperman Zatzal, of his two major works, one was a commentary on the Meshech Chochma, as is known, and the other was a commentary on the Sephorno. And he once told me that he had the opposite intention when he wrote these two commentaries. Meshech Chochma is very difficult to get through. And therefore he said, I wrote the commentary on the Meshech Chochma, Leman Yarutz Bo HaKore, in order that people should be able to read through smoothly through Meshech Chochma. It's not a smooth read without commentary. Leman Yarutz Bo HaKore. He said, I wrote my commentary on the Sforno, Leman Lo Yarutz Bo HaKore. People shouldn't race through, because it's so short, if you race through, it's over before you know it, and you're not sure what he said. And that's why those who know that one needs to sit on every word in the Sforno. And as far as the Sforno is concerned, and it's a Chiddush, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the goal of this opening communication to Avram was not to tell him to go to Eretz Canaan. Hashem never mentioned Eretz Canaan. Avram doesn't need to be told to go to Eretz Canaan. He's on the way anywhere. Anyway, and why is he on the way? And even Terach, and of course if you look in the Psukim, you see it's a little open. Whose initiative was it? And who was leading the pilgrimage or the journey to Eretz Canaan? But seemingly even Terach knows, and certainly Avram knows, in terms of their spiritual compass, that if you're leaving town, the place to go to is Eretz Canaan. And it might be the place to go to even if you weren't leaving town. And that's why they're on the way. That is the place where he can achieve spiritual perfection. That is the place where he can communicate and transmit spiritual elevation to other people, which of course we know that he did. And therefore Avram is going there anyway. When Hashem tells him to go El Ha'aretz Asher Areka, it's not to the land of Israel, but rather it's to a place within the land of Israel. You're going there to that country. I want you to go to the place where I will show you. And the question is, where is that place? And also, how is Hashem going to show Avram where that place is? Because seemingly, he is signaling to Avram that within the country of Eretz Yisrael, there is a certain place there specifically which will be most effective for you to, shall we say, set up your base of operations and be working out of there. So Avram is now in an interesting situation. He's on his way to Eretz Canaan, but he doesn't know where exactly he's meant to end up, where within there. And that is why we find that Pasuk Vav, Vayavor Avram Ba'aretz, Avram is passing through the land. What's he passing through the land for? He's waiting. He's traveling. He's waiting to be told, this is the Aretz. This is the place within the land. And as the Pasuk tells us, Admakom Shechem. He comes to the place of Shechem. Of course, that itself is an interesting shaila. Was it already called Shechem? There's a certain personality who will be called Shechem, very notorious in Parshas Vayishlach. Was he named after the place? Was the place named after him? Is it one of those Al-Shem Ha-Asid? But either way, it's called Makom Shechem Ad Elon Moreh. And why does the Pasuk specify that he reaches Shechem? So Rashi tells us that he had a specific reason or a specific intention when he was in Shechem. Things would happen in Shechem. He already has a portent of the future, and he's davening that things should work out well there in Shechem. But according to the Sephorno, the reason why the Pasuk mentions Shechem specifically is because that was the place. That's the Aretz. It's Shechem. Why Shechem? Mefarshim talk about it, right? What's the yichus of Shechem? But the point is, Pasuk Vav tells us he came to Shechem. He's passing through until he gets to Shechem. And Pasuk Zion says, Vayiro Hashem el Avram. Hashem appears to Avram and gives him this communication. Lezarecha etines aretz, I'll give you this land. And this is the first time Hashem has spoken to Avram from the time he's arrived in Eretz Canaan. And that's the signal. That's our echo. At the point where Hashem appears to Avram, so that's his way of saying, this is the Aretz, this is the place within Eretz Canaan. And thus we find that Avram builds a Mizbeach there in the end of Pasuk Zayin, by Yivin Shal Mizbeach, Lashem Hanir Eilav. And then all of his travels now, in Pasuk Ches, for example, Vayatek Misham, he moves from there. In other words, we can see that this is now the center, which means even as he moves, he's always moving apropos of Shechem. It becomes his base of operations for his kiruv, for his spreading the word about Hashem. And in fact, not only at the time do we see that he works out of Shechem, being the Aretz, Asher Ar-Eka, but even after the famine in the land, and he goes back, he has to go to Egypt for a while, but when he comes back, we see that he gravitates back towards Shechem. And that's in the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, which is the episode of Mitzrayim is behind him, all that trauma with everything with him and Sarah. And it says, Pasuk Gimel Vayelech Lamasa'av. He retraces his steps, Minege Va'ad Beis El, right, back to Beis El, right, which is in that region. And Pasuk Dalet brings him right back, El Mekom HaMizbeach Asher Asa Sham Barishona, to the place of the Mizbeach that he originally made, which was in Shechem. Because having had to leave for a while due to the famine, when he comes back, that's where he comes back to. So this is a very interesting, again, those basic parshanut questions. The Eretz Canaan is never mentioned in Hashem's communication. Avram's going there anyway, and somehow Shechem comes into the picture. According to the Sforno, surprising as it sounds, the Shechem is the Aretz. Asher Ha'Eka is the territory within the Eretz Yisrael, as he describes. But Avram begins to spread the word, and the Rambam describes Avram, actually, in the Mishnah Torah, in the beginning of Hilchos Avodos Kochavim, because he talks about the background and how Avodah Zarah began, and how Avram started to counter it and to combat it. And in the Rambam's words, I'm not sure what his source is, by now it's very easy to look it up, but the Rambam says that when he came to Eretz Canaan, he attracted alofim urevavos, thousands and tens of thousands. The Rambam, as we know, is not given to hyperbole or exaggeration, and here he is saying that Avram attracted thousands and thousands of people. And it's very interesting to see, again, in a nuance, the impact of Avram on the place. If we have a look at Pasuk Ches, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Ches, a very innocent, seemingly, or non-eventful Pasuk, just a geography, one could say, Take me Sham Hahara, right? From there, from Shechem, as we said, he moves towards the mountain, Mi Kedem Le Beis El, Kedem, to the east of Beis El, Vayet Ahalo, and he pitches his tent there. Then the Pasuk says, Beis El Miyam, Beis El is to the west, V'hai Mi Kedem, I is to the east, I is another very important city in the time of Yeshua. It will become a place of actually tragedy initially, Vayivin Sham Mizbeach L'Hashem. At the inauguration of the Kletsk Yeshiva, and Kletsk was there in Russia, and that's where Aaron Kotler actually, his first yeshiva was there. And this is before the war, of course, during the Chanukah Habayis. So one of the people that spoke was a dayan in Slonim, and his name was Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fine. He unfortunately was killed in the Holocaust, but he was known as a great darshan, and they were mechabed him to speak. And his drasha was based on this pasuk, Ches of Perek Yud Beis, the directions of Avram. And he asked a simple shaila. Again, what does the pasuk say? The pasuk says he moved away, Mikedem le Beis El, east of Beis El, and then pitched his tent. And then the next part of the pasuk says Beis El Miyam. Beis El was to the west. Says Rav, fine. How many times do we need to be told, and in how many ways do we need to be told exactly where he was vis-a-vis Beis El? You told me he's to the east of Beis El. I can work out, given enough time, that if he's to the east of Beis El, then Beis El is to the west of him. So if he's Miketa than Beis El, why does it say Beis El Miyam? It says it backwards and forwards, where he is vis-a-vis the place and the place vis-a-vis him. So Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fine said, you know, I had this question for a long time, and the answer came to me during a train journey. Because I'm sitting there on the train, and I overhear two Jews talking. And one, he's on his way to Lida. So he asks his fellow, you know, I know I'm kind of in the right direction, but where exactly is Lida? So his fellow says to him, you know, it's not far from Radin, if that gives you your positioning. And that's basically how he gave him his directions. So Rav Fine said, you know, it occurred to me to wonder just how many people would ever describe Lida as being a few miles away from Radin. As if to say, Lida is a massive city. And Radin is a hamlet. And for most people, they probably know where Lida is, but if they don't, Radin's not going to help them. But not if you're Jewish. And this is the original Jewish geography. As if to say, there's no one who doesn't know where Radin is, because the Chofetz Chaim lives in Radin. Everyone knows where Radin is. It's a center. It's a national center. You might not know where Lida is, so if you want directions, go to Radin and turn left. So it's a sign, really, of the impact of the Chofetz Chaim, that he actually becomes a point of reference for other places. That shows you the prominence that he achieved. Says Rav Fine, Avram Avinu is a stranger. There's a place called Beis El, and he moves near it, and he's to the east of Beis El. But it wasn't long before Avram became such a well-known phenomenon and such a go-to address and such a known location that instead of people saying Avram is a few miles to the east of Beis El, people actually used to give directions to Beis El by saying it's to the west of Avram. Mm. There's no one who doesn't know where Avram is. And that transition, one could say, is really the progression of how Avram has established himself, in the Rambam's words, of Alofim Urevavos. That's how he explained the Pasuk here. He, of course, said, Kletsk is another one of those hamlet towns. No one's heard of Kletsk, but they will. And not only will they hear of it, people will come in time to define other places around it because of Rav Aaron Kotler. I don't know if that happened in Kletsk. It for sure happened in Lakewood, New Jersey, where Rav Aaron Kotler went to. I don't know, 60, 70 years ago, it wasn't much of an address. But now, if you're Jewish, most places in that region are actually describe to you in terms of how far away from Lakewood they are. So that was Refine's prediction for Baron Kotler. And again, as always, being the Talmud Chacham that he is, he knew how to keep his ears open and get assistance in learning Chumash from wherever it might come. So these are some observations and comments with regards to the opening section of the Parsha. But what I'd like to do for quite some time now is to take a look at a section of Parshas Lech Lecha in a way that I will submit is not the way it is normally looked at all. But as we will see, once our eyes are opened, we will leave, if we can quote the pasuk later in the Parsha, Birchush Gadol. We have a principle of Ma'ase Avos Siman Labanim, that the deeds, the experiences of the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they are a siman, or perhaps more than a siman, more than a sign for the descendants. As we've discussed many times, whenever we raise this concept of Ma'ase Avos Siman Labanim, it's not merely information, it's a sign. But it actually enables the experience of the Bonim. Every miracle, as Ramban says, in order to assure its success in this world, the ruchnius energy really needs to be brought into the world first. And that's why many prophecies are accompanied by some type of symbolic act. It's actually harnessing that energy in order to then allow it to play out. If that's true for miracles generally, there's no greater miracle than the history of the Jewish people. And therefore the trigger acts, the catalyst, the enabling acts for Jewish history are the Ma'ase Avos. They're the experiences of the Avos. Every major thing that happens to the Jewish people can be found in the lives of the Avos. And we are looking actually for the one occasion in the year, which is a major Torah occasion, but for obvious reasons is not mentioned in the Chumash or the Tanakh. And that is the festival of Chanukah. All of the others, between the Daraisas and the Drabanans, make it in. The Daraisas, of course, are in the Araisa. They're right there, all the Yomim Tovim. And Purim is Purim in Megillas Esther. Hanukkah, of course, comes after that. And the question is it possible to find a Ma'ase Avos for the festival of Hanukkah? And the answer, as we will see, is yes, and in Parshas Lech Lecha. But before we get there, before we talk about the roots of Hanukkah, there's actually pre-roots, in a sense. Because it happens to be that on the most, I would say, primordial level, our first encounter with Yavan, which will come to represent the adversary in Hanukkah with Greece, preceded the Avos. Our first encounter with Yavan is actually in Parshas Noach. And it comes in the form of a partnership between our ancestor and theirs. We refer, of course, to the collaboration of Shem and Yefes, where Noah is lying in a state of disgrace in his tent, whatever he was looking to achieve there, it backfired, and he's there in a state of disgrace, he's uncovered. Ham thinks it's very amusing, and he tells his brothers. His brothers do not think it's amusing, and they take action to preserve the dignity, restore and preserve the dignity of their father. The pasuk says, "Vayikach Shem vayefes es asimla." They take a sheet, they walk backwards. Everything is done kamosh tzarich in order to cover him over. So what's interesting is the very first encounter of what will become the Jewish people with what will become Greece is with Shem. And Yefes, Shem is the ancestor of Avram, of course, and Yefes of Yavan. And they're actually working together, which is very interesting, because it seems that they have something in common. However, their partnership is limited. As if to say, it is they have a commonality in practice, in goal, but not completely. And how do we see this? Because as we know, and Rashi comments on this, the pasuk which describes them getting involved in this starts with the word vayikach in the singular. Vayikach, Shem, vayefes, es asimla. Now, of course, there's two of them. Should be vayikru. And one could gloss over it or work it out. But Rashi says vayikach is because as much as there were two of them, but one of them t- took it more. One of them was more, for him it was more of the essence to do this, and the other one then joined in. That's really, you get from this amazing blend of the singular with more than one person involved, because one of them was involved in a singular way, more than the other. And that's shame. Why was shame involved more than the other? Why was he more galvanized he responded quicker? Because for Shem, there's more at stake. With their father lying in a state of disgrace, it bothers both of them, but it bothers Shem more. It bothers Yefes, because Yefes already represents Yofi, and this is an anti-aesthetic situation. So he's prepared to join in. If someone wants to restore dignity, to human dignity, to their father, he'll for sure join in. But it's much more of an imperative for Shem, because Shem subscribes to higher notions. Their father and what he represents and what a human being represents. Tzelem Elokim, where disgrace, it's a much more urgent situation for Shem. And therefore he takes the initiative and Yefes joins in. So they're together, but still separate in terms of the nuance of what it is that they're acting towards. And by the way, we can see this very interestingly in the reward that they get, because they both get their blessings. And Rashi tells us that in reward for this act, Shem was zoche to talis shel mitzvah, that is to say, it's already beginning to, we would use the term again, harness the energy that will become the mitzvah of talis. It's right, beget shel mitzvah, talis shel mitzvah, for his descendants. That's his reward. And what's Yefes' reward? That it says, Rashi, it's quoting the Medrash, that his descendants in the war of Gog Magog, so those that fall will receive a burial, right? Not everyone who falls will, but they will. So these are two, and we've noted in the past, very quite different rewards, one from the other. They don't seem to have a relationship of, you know, first prize and second prize. You know, the winner gets talis shel mitzvah, and then second place gets his descendants get buried when they fall on the battlefield. I mean, there seems to be quite a lag between those two. But the point is, you see with each son, the reward is commensurate with the deed. As if to say, because Shem is motivated by mitzvah concerns, and of course that took the form of using a garment or a sheet to cover over Noah, so if he was activated for mitzvah purposes, his reward will be a mitzvah. Yefes is not interested in mitzvahs. He relates to human dignity. And therefore, the reward that he will get is that his descendants will receive that dignity of, and it is a dignity, that they'll be spared from that disgrace of just being unburied. That's episode one, what we could call, when they're partners. The next time the progenitors of Israel and Greece meet, they will not be partners. They will be adversaries. And that happens in Parshas Lech Lecha. How so? If we would describe in one sentence Hanukkah, and many of the best things can really be put into one sentence, we would say that it's a what was it? It took the place of an idealistic war waged by a small group of people led by Kohanim, which they were victorious against a much greater adversary, leading to the chinuch, to the restoration, rededication of the Beis Hamikdash. I think that's a fair summary. There's plenty of commentary, as we know. Hanukkah is not 8 days for nothing. But that, in a sentence, is Hanukkah. Okay. What does that have to do with us? We mention in preface that the Gemara tells us there is great significance with regards to a concept, a word, a term, or a concept, the first time you find it in the Chumash. That already gives you, in a sense, the essence of that thing. The Gemara says it. It's known as a Hasidic idea, Reb Tzadok and others, but actually the roots are in the Gemara. The first mention is the essence of the matter. Okay. Achar hadvarim ha'eleh. Let us take a look at chapter 14 of Bereishis. And what do we find? We find that you have this war. Initially the four kings, they're more powerful than the five. They take over the region. They also capture Lot. And Avram gets involved. And there are a number of firsts here. The first is that this is the first war, which is quite general in nature, but nonetheless. And this idea and the approach that we're building on, it was actually developed by Rav Leib Hyman Zatzal, the Rav of Beit Knesset Hagra, who was full of very incredible insights. So this is the first war ever in Tanakh is here. Needless to say, if we would describe the miracle of Hanukkah as Rabim Biyad Me'atim, the many in the hands of the few, there is no greater expression of the many in the hands of the few than Avram's war against these four armies. He sets out with what the Pasuk calls 318 students, and that's assuming that there's actually 318 of them, right? There's gematrias in play, which could make them Eliezer. But assuming that there's actually 318, that's Me'atim. And they wage this war against Rabim. It's also very interesting that his charges, or his students, what are they called? Pasuk Yudalit, Vayishma Avram, of Perik Yudalit, Pasuk Yudalit, Vayishma Avram, Ki Nishba Achiv. Avram hears that his relative has been captured. Vayorek, who does he activate? Who does he enlist? Vayorek es chanichav. He enlists his chanichim. What's a chanich? What does it mean? Rashi explains. Chanich is, v'hu loshon, it's the beginning of something. It's the inauguration of something. The dedication of something. V'hu loshon hascholas kenisas ha'adam. It's the introduction of a person, okli, or a vessel. L'umnus shu osed lamed bo. For its calling, what it will ultimately be used for. Like chanuch lanar, v'chein chanuch lanar, says Rashi. That's chinuch. And chanukas hamizbeach, and chanukas habayis. So Chanukah is rooted in chanichav of Avram. That's where Chanukah begins. And as we know, the ones who spearheaded the revolt on Chanukah were Kohanim, Ayidei Avadecha Kohanim. Okay. After the war, someone comes out to greet Avram, the famous Malki Tzedek. Malki Tzedek Melech Sholem. Pasuk Yud Ches. Malki Tzedek Melech Sholem. Hotzi Lechem Ve'yayin. He brings them out bread and wine. V'hu Kohen Lekel Elyon. He's a Kohen. Whatever Kohen means. But this is the first mention of the word Kohen in the Torah. You've got your first war, your first Chanukah, your first Kohen. Rabim Biyad Ma'atim. We're looking at the Maisa Avos of Chanukah. And in fact, it goes further. Because we need to identify, you've got four kings. And they mentioned by name a couple of times. Which of them is Avram's principal adversary, we may ask? Can we know? Well, if you look in the beginning of Perek Yudalet, we'll see they're listed. Vayihi, if you know the Psukim, Vayihi Bimei Amraphel Melech Shinar, that's number one. Ariyoch Melech Halazar is number two. Kedar Laomer Melech Elam is number three. And Sidal Melech Goyim is number four. There you go. In case you wanted to know what their names were, there we have it. Okay. So who is mentioned first? Amraphel. Then Ariyoch, then Kedar Laomer, and then Sidal. It's very interesting, and naturally Meforshim all will respond to this, that this is the only time that they will be mentioned in this order. We will find them again, mentioned by name, in a different order, for some reason. And that is, you'll have a look in Pasuk Tes. Es Kedar Laomer Melech Elam, right? The whole thing over again. Kedar Laomer Melech Elam, Sidon Melech Goyim, Amrapha Melech Shinar, Baryoch Melech Alasar, the four kings. So I think we have enough to deal with without the order being reversed. What's the correct order and why is it changed? What we do notice is that Kedar Laomer, in the initial listing, is third. But then subsequently, somehow he becomes first. In fact, he is so first in the list, that there are a couple of places in the Perek where, when the kings are mentioned, they're not even listed anymore. They're called Kedar Laomer and all the others. We have, for example, Pasuk Hey. You have these the five kings. They tried their hand. They tried to revolt. Didn't work. Ubar Besrei Shana. Who comes? Kedar Laomer Vamlachim Asherito. Kedar Laomer, and the king's with him. So all the other three, not only are they numbers 2, 3, and 4, they're not even numbered as often as not. There is no question that somehow, although he was initially third on the list, Kedar Laomer moves to pole position. He assumes primacy in this episode. And the question is, why? And if he's so prominent, how come he was third initially? I mean, what did he get? Was this is that a field promotion or the like? I mean, these are different kingdoms. So the answer to all of this is in the Medrash. Because the Medrash itself, Bereishis Rabbah, actually identifies, and there's many, many fours, as we know, and one always has to regard them carefully, not to act in a cavalier manner. But this is one of those fours which is considered to be the roots of Arba Golios. Which means if we take a look at the four kings from the very beginning, as they're listed. So the first is Amraphel Melech Shinar. Now we know that Shinar is Bavel. We were told that in last week's Parsha. Originally they come to a place called Shinar, and then the Pasuk says, because everything got mixed up, the languages, it became known as Bavel. So Shinar is Bavel. That corresponds to Golas Bavel. Second is Arioch Melech Elasar. And Elasar is another name for Modai, media. And Modai is synonymous with the second Golas. We always talk about it as Persia and media, Golas Paros u'Modai. So Elasar, which is Modai, is the second. So what about Elam? Elam, so the Gemara says that the Greek empire that emerged actually didn't start in Greece. It started in Elam, Besamtiki Si'i Be'Elam, which is it's somewhere, I think, to the south of Persia, and that's when they kind of achieved their strength and whatever, and then they took over Greece and became the Greek empire. So Kedar Laomer Melech Elam represents Golas Yavan. And that brings us to number four. So which is the fourth location? So interestingly, there is no location for number four, because the fourth king is called Besidal Melech Goyim. And when you think about it, that sounds like the least helpful description that you could imagine, because there were only Goyim back in the day. So if you tell me that he was the king of this place, and that he was of this place, and he was this place, and what about the fourth one? Who was he king of? Goyim. It doesn't seem to give me much to go on. And yet, it is the most accurate description for the simple reason that the fourth Golus, which began with Rome, but it's not restricted to any one nation. It is really international. It's actually more correct, ultimately, to refer to it as Goyim, as many nations, than to any particular nation. There'll be other places where Rome will be identified, but if you want to understand why number four is called Goyim, look around, and you see the Golus is really under the auspices of numerous nations. And so, we can understand why initially the kings are ordered the way they are, because that's the order of the four Goliaths. Mm-hmm. First Bavel, Modai, Yavan, and then all other nations, number four. But if you want to know why rapidly Kedar Laomer takes over as the prime antagonist towards Avram, it's because this is the Maisa Abbas, first and foremost, for Golas Yavan, and Kedar Laomer is Melech Elam, and he represents the third Golas. It's interesting that Avram's war, again, it's the type of war that the Hashmonaim would wage. In other words, other wars the Jewish people have fought for their survival. In Hanukkah, they're not fighting for their survival per se. If they change all of their values temporarily, in temporal terms, they will survive. But the point is, they went to war over those values. And so did Avram. In other words, for him, it's not to conquer territory wherever, it's a value. The value happens to be family. But the point is, and as we've noted in the past, Avram is called Ivri. Avram's ideological position is summed up in the term Ivri for many reasons, as the Medrash discusses. He is an heir of Aver. He has a contrary position to others, right? He's prepared to take a stand against the world on certain things. They're all me Aver one, he's me Aver the other, and so on and so forth. But it's very interesting to note that he's only ever called Ivri once in the entire Chumash. It's the type of thing that you wouldn't be surprised if he'd be called Ivri a lot, because we're so used to it, Avram Ivri. But he's only called it once in the Chumash, I think once in the whole Tanakh. And where is that place? It's here, in Parshas Lech Lecha. When the refugee comes, which is in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayavo HaPalit, the refugee comes, whoever he is, Og, Vayaged LaAvram HaIvri. Of all the places to call Avram an Ivri, it's not the first time we've mentioned him, it's not the last, and but never before and never again. So what's so unusual about this place, or what's so noteworthy? But the point is, because Avram is really being petitioned as an Ivri, and he acts as an Ivri. He goes to war over values. And that, of course, is the Maisa Avos for the ultimate war of values, which was waged by the Chashmonaim. There is a further point, which is actually unbelievable within this. We talk in conceptual terms, in value terms. We talk about Hanukkah as us against Greece, and in value terms it was, because it was us against Greek values. But we never really fought the Greeks. Not really. Because after Alexander the Great died, and he was from Macedonia / Greece, but after he died, so his empire got split into three. And one of them, and one of, between his generals, Antigonus, one of them took Greece itself, and that's that. And then in terms of the Middle East, so there were two of them, Seleucus and Ptolemy. And one was to the north, more, and one was to the south, like Egypt. Ptolemy was in Egypt. And of course, Israel, as always, was in the middle. And that's why a lot of our experience in under Greek domination actually fluctuated between under Egyptian control and under Syria, because they were fighting each other. We shouldn't think they all made shalom, as if to say, well, like they're all Greeks, so they all see eye to eye in everything. They became really distinct empires, politically distinct empires, which means they may have the same views on art, but they don't have the same views as to who should occupy more territory. There happens to be a machlokas between them, and Israel was always caught in the middle. So, for example, the translation of the Torah into Greek was done at the behest or command of Ptolemy. Because that was during one of our Egyptian times when we were conquered by Egypt. But of course, the events of Hanukkah took place much later, and at that stage, Israel is not under control of Egypt. It's in control of the north, and the north was based in Syria. And in fact, the capital, the Greek capital in Syria, is a place called Antioch, and that's where all the emperors from there are called Antiochus. And where is that? Where is Antioch? It's in the north. It's way in the north of Syria. In fact, it's so much in the north, I think, from what I've heard, it's actually Turkey now. It's actually southern Turkey. The borders change a little bit. Fine. Either way. Okay. So, and what that means is that ideologically, the war was with Greece. But practically, it was with Syria. Now, where are you going to find Syria in the Torah? Parshas Lech Lecha. In this war. How so? Because if we look at Pasuk Tesvav, Perik Yudalad, Pasuk Tesvav, Vayechalek Alehem Laila, right, so they split the night between them, right, in this pursuit. Huva Avadav Vayakem, Avram, his servants, Vayakem, and they smote mightily all of these armies. And they even pursued them. Right? They gave chase. By your defame. Where did they chase them to? To a place called Chova. Rashi says there is no place called Chova. I mean, it's a characteristic name. But don't look for a place called Chova. Is there any other way we can get a location on Chuvah? Says the pasuk, yeah. Asher mismol Damascus, is to the north of Damascus. This is the only place where Damascus is a place is mentioned in the Torah, or any other place in Syria. And in fact, given the fact that Antioch was not yet named, the best way to refer to it is actually a place to the north of Damascus, which is because Smol, Yamin and Smol, you're always considered to be facing east in direction. So Yamin and Smol is really south and north. So Smol of Damascus is to the north of Damascus. So actually Avram originally chased the enemy back to where they would then come again in Hanukkah, from Smol of Damascus. As the Eliezer also for Damascus, that's right. Damascus Eliezer. So you have a lot of foretelling here in terms of the Hanukkah story. And then what happens? After the war, so the king of Sodom comes out, and as is the minhag with such leaders in this region, he has no shame, and he's prepared to negotiate because he has nothing to give. So, Vayetze Melech Sodom, and he says to Avram, give me back the people, and you take all the rechush. But Avram doesn't want to take the rechush. And how does he express that? Famously. So we are now in Pasuk Kaf Aleph of Perek Yud Aleph. Vayomer Melech Sodom El Avram. So the king of Sodom says to Avram, Teli Anefesh, give me the people of Rechush Kachlach. And Avram gives him back the people, interestingly, including Lot, which is itself quite noteworthy, as if to say, you know, Lot has gotten into enough trouble in Sodom, and Avram went to war for him. One might have thought that either Lot himself would show the good grace of saying, well, maybe I shouldn't really live in Sodom anymore. Or certainly one might have thought that Avram would recommend to Lot that you might want him to live somewhere else. But actually, he doesn't interfere with Lot. Lot could get captured again in a month's time. But Avram allows him to go back. Fine. But Teli Anefesh, give me the people back. Rechush Kachach, you can keep the Rechush. Avram doesn't want the Rechush for any number of reasons. But what does he say? Pasuk Kaf Beis. Vayomer Avram El Melach Sodom. He famously declares, Harimosi Yadim Yadi El Hashem Kel Elyon. I raise up my hand to Hashem. I'm not going to take anything. Including what? Or extending to what? In Michut Vatzrochnal. I'm not going to take a thread. I'm not going to take a shoe strap. And nothing. And those terms are very significant, and they themselves will now begin to have significance for mitzvah significance for his future, because the Gemara says in the merit of him saying in michut, he's not even going to take a thread. And it's an interesting phrase, by the way, because between a thread and a shoe strap, there doesn't seem to be that much range. So it doesn't really sound, you know, from beginning to end or from A to Z. It's more like from Y to Z, and you're left out, actually, most things. What exactly does it mean? Michut Batzrochnal. I heard from Rav Kuperman, actually, that the chut that he's referring to was the thread that they would wear like as a headband, so to speak. So it's like saying from top to toe. That's what it means, right? From the head thread to the shoe strap, nothing. That's already, from one extreme to the other. Either way, says the Gemara in Maseches Sota. In reward for him saying in Michut, he's not even going to take a thread, so he was zocha to the thread of Techeles, which is very interesting, because actually what we see here is, in a sense, the mitzvah of tzitzis has been, or the roots, the spiritual roots, or the spiritual catalysts of the mitzvah of tzitzis are actually shared between these two episodes. In other words, if you go back to shame, and shame, in a sense, his good deed gave for his descendants talis shel tzitzis, talis shel mitzvah, and then Avram brings in the threads, because essentially they're really two installments of the same encounter. In other words, in the same way that Shem preserves, even when he's collaborating with Yefes, but he preserves a sense of what a mitzvah is, and therefore he begins the mitzvah of tzitzis, which is a very temporal thing. Tzitzis is a beged, but it becomes a mitzvah because that's the way Shem looks at the world. And Avram completes it. You see, in a sense, together they put together the mitzvah of tzitzis, because together they are formulating the basis of our response to Yavan. Whether you collaborate with them, which sometimes happens, or whether you need to go to war against them, which also sometimes happens. There is actually an amazing practice. It's mentioned in one of our earliest halachic sources. I don't think people are knowing this way, Lamaisa. I've learned not to speak for global Jewry. There's so many different minhagim, you never know. One can never generalize. Often one suffers from urban Ashkenazi ignorance. But I'd be interested to know if anyone actually does this. Because the Rav Achai, that is to say from the Gaonim, Rav Achai Gaon, he wasn't formerly a Gaon, but from the time of the Gaonim, the Sheiltas, we have his work. It's one of the earliest organized works, of systematic halachic works. It's from 700-800s, whenever it is. And the Gemara says that when you light the menorah, so the menorah is on the left and the mezuzah is on the right. And that's our girsa in the Gemara. But the girsa of the Sheiltas is that when a person lights a menorah, so you have the menorah on the left, the mezuzah on the right, and a person is wearing a talis in the middle. So that's very interesting because there's no other mitzvah where there's insistence that a person wear a talis, unless it's, you know, for a tzibur or something like that. And again, it's towards evening and maybe even post-evening, so there's no longer actually a mitzvah tzitzis, daytime-wise. And still, you know, all the mitzvahs, he's like insistent that a person should wear a talis. But actually, according to this, I think we understand, or maybe a further level of understanding, that actually the mitzvah of talis is what Chanukah is all about, right? It began with Shem and Avram, and they're the ones who got the mitzvah tzitzis going, and therefore it should certainly be represented when you light the Chanukah, which celebrates the Siman Labonim victory over over Yavon there. But there is a further point. Because if we come back to this, again, Avram refuses to take anything. And he introduces his refusal with the words in Pasuk Kaf Beis, Ayom Avram Amel HaSodom, Harimosi Adi El Hashem Kel Elyon. I raise up my hands before Hashem Kel Elyon, God on high. And what does that mean? So Rashi says, it's an expression of Shavuah. It's a present tense. I raise my hands as a solemn declaration, which is, it's very interesting that it was such an emphasis. How many times does Avram swear about anything that he himself will do? Never, actually, as far as I know, in the whole of all the parshas we have about it. Just here. He emphasizes this with force of a Shavuah. But interestingly, Unkelus does not translate Harimosi Adi as an expression of an oath. And in fact, not only does he not translate it as an expression of an oath, he doesn't translate it even as a present tense. He translates it as a past tense, which it could be. Harimosi, I did. I am or I did. Unkelus says, I did. What did you do? So Unkelus says, where are we? Aremis yadai bit slow, kadam Hashem. I raised my hands bit slow. Slow as in solosa. Tiskavot solosahon uvusa. Solosa is prayer. When, according to Unkelus, when Avram says Harimosi Adi El Hashem, he's saying I raise my hands in prayer before Hashem, and that's a prelude to him saying I'm not taking anything from you. Why? Because what Avram is saying is, according to Unkelus, I don't deserve any of this. You know, if I somehow felt that I had made this conquest by myself, so maybe these are spoils of war, and whoever conquers, so then he's entitled to them. That's how it goes. But Avram is saying, and this is how Rabbi Shulai Diskin explains Unkelus. Avram is saying, but that's not right here, because there's no way that this naturally could have happened. And in fact, the real answer is, I raised my hands in prayer before Hashem, and that's how it happened. I can't claim this as my own conquest, and therefore I'm not going to take anything from here, because I'm not entitled to spoils of war. So in other words, according to Unkelus, Avram's refusal is his emphatic refusal is an expression of his recognition as to where his Rabbim Biyad Ma'atim success came from. And that recognition is at the heart of the Chanukah story. Because the Maharal and others explain that after the victory on the battlefield, so they made their way, Achakach Ba'uvanecha, they made their way to the Beis HaMikdash, they lit the menorah, and the menorah miraculously lasted for 8 days, which was a miracle that wasn't necessary by normal standards, or by normal metrics of what's necessity. Worst case scenario, they could have used tamei oil, maybe. And worst case, they wouldn't have any oil. So then you can't do the mitzvah. Onus rachmana patre. If you don't have the wherewithal, you can't do it. It happens. So why did Hashem give them a miracle that they didn't need? The answer, says Maharal, is they did need it. They didn't need it for the fulfillment of lighting the menorah, but they needed it in order to be under no misapprehension as to where the miracle on the battlefield came from. In other words, the miracle of the oil, they should realize they're living in a zone of miracles, so they should then join the dots to what they just experienced to realize the same Hashem who's making this oil last for however, which, by the way, is also, in a sense, rabbin biyad ma'atim. In other words, if you have one day's oil acting way beyond, many times beyond its natural capacity, that's them. They were acting many times beyond their natural capacity in terms of their ability to drive out the enemy to the extent that they did. And therefore, critical to the festival of Hanukkah was that recognition. Without it, there would be no Hanukkah. It would just have been a temporal or short-lived celebration of this, and maybe would have been forgotten in the course of time. Why has that victory not been forgotten? Because they knew how to frame it. They knew how to recognize it. And they knew how to relate to it. But that itself is also, when you think about it, they are heirs of Avram's declaration, Harimosi Adia, Lashem Kel Elyon. Where did my success come from? I raised my hands in prayer. Hashem delivered them into my hands. He's the one who's responsible for my success. In Avram's time, that led to his refusal to take anything. In their time, it led to the institution of Hanukkah, to the miracle of the menorah and of Hanukkah itself. One final point, and that is. There's one person, in other words, we have two distinct episodes here. You've got way back in the day, prehistory as far as we're concerned, with Shem and Yefes, and then you've got Avram, and two historical things connected in theme. But are they connected in any other way? They are, by a very interesting personality. And that is none other than Malkitzedek. Malkitzedek Melech Shalem. And he's mentioned in... Who is Malkitzedek? Rashi tells us. He's Shem ben Noah. In other words, Shem, actually, he comes out and he's the one that brings refreshments and makes a kiddush for Avram and his beleaguered soldiers, because Shem himself has a particular delight here, because he is seeing the culmination of a process that he began all those many, many years ago. He was the first one to identify that Shem and Yefes do not see actually eye to eye in every respect, even when they're collaborating in the same venture. And he maintained that perspective, and he saw it come out. He was a partner with Yefes. Avram, his descendant, is now an adversary with the descendant of Yefes. But in the same way that Shem stood firm, so did Avram, and therefore Shem registers his joy over what his descendant has done, because he has now seen the process through. He's seen the roots now completed in round two of encounters, and the rest, of course, literally is history. So, as I said, this is not, I don't think, the standard way that people learn through Parshat Lech Lecha. But as soon as the great Rav Hyman opens the doors, opens the floodgates, one can really see more. So in case you're ever wondering, when exactly do preparations for Hanukkah begin? The answer we now know is Parshas Lech Lecha. We'll leave it over here for this evening.